2, Romeo India Whiskey here. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet. TechNet number 1380 of the series that began in September 1982. Lots of them. Main purpose of the TechNet is that amateur radio operators get together and answer each other's questions, usually on technical subjects, but sometimes on the legality and the philosophy of ham radio. No guarantee that all the answers are going to be perfectly accurate at first, but nobody has a batting average that's 1,000, so we do the best we can. People point out our errors. We admit them in the future weeks and eventually get all straightened out. Ham radio is a fairly complicated technical hobby. There's 26 or so different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. So we try to teach each other something about the other 25, for those who have got some hands-on experience with that. How do those transmission lines work and how to make them work better? How do the antennas work? Propagation? Meteor scatter? There was a meteor shower this week, which we'll probably discuss that a little bit. There was Ham Radio University today. We'll probably discuss that a little bit. Let me drop. I'm doing an experiment right now, and that is that I'm transmitting without a PL tone. So it looks like the machine's back in the normal operation. This particular repeater, most of the time, requires a 136.5 PL tone in order for the repeater to repeat your signal. And during the TechNet, that function is rescinded, and everybody can sign in even without a PL tone. So that can be handy. Everyone's welcome to sign into the TechNet. As long as you do have a question or a comment. We don't need a long list of names of people that are listening. After 29 years, we believe somebody is listening. This repeater has a, let me drop this, a rather good coverage of northern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, much of Long Island, the New York City metropolitan area. We believe there's a lot of brain power in that metropolitan area, and the TechNet attempts to tap into that brain power. When someone asks a question, hopefully of the tens or hundreds of people that are listening, and by way of Echolink and IRLP, there are people even in other states and other countries listening. So when someone recognizes a question being asked where he has specific knowledge, we welcome him to sign in and give us the benefit of his knowledge. So that's part of why the TechNet is so successful from my point of view. A person signs into the technical net by giving me and John. John is KC2WGB. You'll be hearing some more about him later. You give John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. And this is what the order of business is going to be like. For those who sign in at the beginning of the TechNet, we make a sincere promise that we try to answer everyone within the first hour, at least briefly. So between 8 o'clock and a little bit after 9 o'clock, we try to answer everyone's questions briefly. At around 9 o'clock or a little bit later, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And then the next thing on the agenda is John, KC2WGB, will tell us what new questions he's gotten from what we sometimes call Mel's Corner. In other words, Mel, KC2KEY, a silent key, used to collect large numbers of emails per week from people who don't yet have their license and have questions to be answered. The majority of the TechNet is live, vocal, on-the-spot answers to people's questions. We're not promising
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now, the TechNet is not promising to try to supply a written, free consulting service. That's a little bit beyond the call of duty. But John does try to keep up with the beginning amateurs with their questions. And what he selects are the more general ones that he thinks will have lots of appeal, and we bring them to the TechNet and discuss them. After John's presentation and after Paul's presentation, we then go into the more serious material. That more serious material is an ongoing experiment, and if you want to see see the latest things where you can download the schematic diagrams, the YouTube videos, and whatever, so that you can participate into that more serious experiment, you simply go to the website of Bernie at huntfamily.com. That's B-E-R-N-I-E, Bernie at Hunt, H-U-N-T, family.com. K2 Yankee Oscar. Bernie is supplying that service by which we can therefore distribute schematics and the videos where the more serious discussion takes place. That more serious discussion, let me drop. Update, Dick. Yeah, go ahead, John.
KC2WGV. Dick, also Bernie has established at Weimark a thing called Dropbox. Anybody who has that available to them can get them without even going through Bernie. They can go right to Dropbox. I don't know if that information is, but I know it's active right now. In fact, I added stuff today.
So let me double-check that one now, John. If I understand correctly, a person goes to limarc.org, L-I-M-A-R-C, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, abbreviation, limarc.org, and I think you're saying of all the things that you can check into there, one of them is called Dropbox. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
That's correct. One word. How they may access that, I'm not positive, but I know that's available, so that'll be a good point to bring up. This way, Bernie doesn't have to ship the emails out.
So it probably is active right now. I guess a person right now has the choice of either going to Bernie at huntfamily.com or Lockbox, Dropbox. But I guess in the future, the main point of contact for information that's being discussed on the serious sections at the end of the net is Dropbox. You have reason to believe that that's active right now, John? Go ahead.
Yes, it is, Dick, and I loaded some last week and this week, some of the pictures that of Glenn's transformer. But Bernie was kind enough to set that up for us, and that should make it a lot easier for people who can navigate the web and get onto Limark, and they'll be able to click on what you're talking about.
And for those who want to know exactly what this is, Wesley is involved. Wesley, John, and others, I guess Glenn and Eric, are involved in a fairly serious project investigating a certain kind of electrical phenomena. A number of serious scientists in Europe have for a good number of years been experimenting with something that they call over-unity. In other words, kinds of machinery, electronic, which you put in, say, for instance, 100 watts and get greater than 100 watts output. Is it real? And how do you investigate it? How do you make the measurements for confirmation? That's part of what's really going on. So this is an ongoing experiment. It's not to everyone's liking. It's part of the reason why we do it at the end of the TechNet. And there's a good learning process that takes place there as we discover methods of properly exciting the machinery and properly making the measurements. Okay. A person, as I said, signs in by giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in.
2 meter. Transmit.
A typical sign-in might sound like this. KD2BHY, Jim, and yes. So, I'm taking check-ins at this time. Please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you do have a question and a comment. K2RIW.
KD2RFM, Alan, yes. Question, please?
Yes.
Okay, that was a quadruple. The first one I heard was Alan, KC2RFN. One at a time, you guys try again.
WB2HWW with a question.
Okay. Alan was first, Howie was second, Rich is third, N2EO, in the way I heard them. Anyone else?
K2TGW, Les, yes.
Okay, we got Les. It's number four. So we've got Alan, Howard, Rich, and Les. Anyone else?
No.
Okay, that was a double. I know that one of them was no. We're primarily emphasizing the people who do have a yes. Anyone else with a yes, give me your call letters and name at this time with that yes.
KD2
W-H-Y, yes?
Okay, we got you, Jim. And, Jim, do you have a problem as to how late you can stay up tonight? In other words, if we don't get to you until almost 9 o'clock, is that okay, Jim? Over to you, Jim.
It's okay.
Very good. One other thing I ought to mention to you guys is that I have a fairly important meeting early tomorrow morning, so I'm going to have to leave you guys at midnight tonight. We're not going to go beyond midnight. 4 hours of the tech net is all you're going to get tonight. Alrighty. After Jim, was there anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time with the word yes if you do have a question or a comment.
WGB with a question after everybody else, of course.
Okay, some mysterious guy named John with another question. All right, got more than enough. Alan, KCQRFN. Alan, by the way, is the guy who nominated the technical net for the national award that it got in the year 2011 for technical service. And so go right ahead, Alan. KC2RFN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2RFN, and we miss you at HRU today, Dick. My question is one about, I think it's interference, but interesting phenomenon. I was on 10 meters the other day, and I've noticed this before. I'll notice that there's an interference, almost like a staticky tone. And in the case of the other day, it started at 28.120, and then every time I turned up almost exactly 30 kilohertz, I would get the next note on a scale, like a musical scale. So at 28.120, I might hear, and then at 130, I might hear, and then at 60, I hear, and it would go. I actually was able to listen to the scaling effect all the way up to 28.500. And I was wondering what that might be and why I'm hearing it in this very organized but odd way.
I'm not sure we've got the whole answer on this one, Alan, but I'll tell you what little was known. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think it was Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y, or someone else, brought to our attention that there is a 28 megacycle region signal that apparently is being placed on the power lines by Long Island Lighting Company. We think it's got something to do with their automatic metering or automatic telemetry, and we believe that those individual tones are all 60 hertz related. In other words, one of those tones is at 180 hertz, which is the third harmonic of 60, and then the sixth harmonic is 360 and so on. So I think if you make a careful measurement of those tones, and you can do that by way of a lizardew pattern. In other words, if you have an oscilloscope connected to the audio output of your receiver, and the vertical plates have the 60 hertz, the vertical plates have the audio output, the horizontal sweep of the spectrum of the signal, here we go, of the oscilloscope, you set that on line sync. In other words, you sync it to the 60 cycle line. When you do that, quite possibly the audio tones that you're hearing as you go to each one of those frequencies will all be a fixed number of cycles on the horizontal sweep that's sweeping at 60 times per second, so to speak. That's what little I know. I know that some of you guys have got some more information on this. This is what I remembered from about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Anyone who knows about that mysterious set of signals at 28 megs, and I hear tell those who live near a Long Island Lighting Company power station, light by Long Island Power Authority power substation, tend to hear the signals a little bit louder. If you've got more smarts on this, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
WTV.
Okay, that was John, and I heard a double. Who was the other person?
AK1NS, Dave.
WB2HWW with some information about interference on the 10-meter band.
Okay, we've got three guys now. So we've got John, Dave, and Howard. John first, KC2WGB. Tell us what we know about that one, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, don't forget the files interface connection. That was one of the problems that we found, and it was at periodic rates on the 10-meter band. So that is, you know, if you turn the box off, it, of course it stops. So that was one thing we had.
Call from 4411.
So I think like you said, when you're doing that investigation of that 28 meg signal that was in your house, it's when you pulled the fuse or the circuit breaker that fed your Fios system, then it disappeared in your case. Is that approximately what happened, John? Back to you, John.
At first, I turned the router off, and it went away. But then I left the router on and disconnected the interconnect to the computer, the 10-base T wiring, and it disappeared also. So it's radiating from the wires from the connection port on the computer to the interface jacks, the RJ45s in the back. If those cables are shielded, it eliminates it.
And once again, John, where do you believe is the real source of the Nile in this case? The original signal itself, yes, the shielding of the wiring to your router, to your computer, and whatever, aggravates the problem. But where is the real source? Is it the modulator, demodulator, fiber optic, optical thing of Fios? Is that the approximate source from your experience, John, first, KC2WGB, K2LIW?
The noise seems to be coming directly out of the network ports in the back. They usually give you 5 network ports with the RJ45. That's where the noise is coming from, so I believe it emanates from the box. Maybe it's not filtered properly. It does not seem to be coming from the computer. So when I brought my sniffer near the box at those outlets, I could pick the noise up. So I'm pretty sure it's coming out of the box itself.
Okay, when you're saying the box, make it a little bit more clear. What is the box? It's what brand name doing what function? Over to you, John.
It's the box that was supplied by Fios, and it is the. It also transmits an RF. It has a little antenna on it, and that box is the problem, as far as I can tell. I didn't go any further because just shielding the wires could stop it. Now, why, when I unplug it, if I go near the wires coming from the computer, my sniffer does not pick up the noise. But if I get very close to the RJ45 jacks with it, I can pick the noise up. So I'm almost positive it's coming from that box, which is their interface network box. So that's all I found.
And I've got another question now. You're saying your interface box to your Fios fiber network has an antenna on it. That antenna is intended to send a signal where, for what function, if you happen to know, John. Go ahead.
Yes, it transmits, I believe, in a 2.4 gig band, and that's for your laptop computers with your little card in it. You plug an RF card into the ATA port or whatever you have on the computer, or some of them have it built into the computer, and it transmits to that little antenna. A wonderful system. It works pretty well, too.
Update that.
I think you're talking about now the 802.11 system. Before we go to Dave and Howard, the original question was asked by Alan, and he wants to update us. KC2RFN, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, after listening to John, I shut off my router, instantly eliminated the problem.
Well, could be it.
Now, Alan, does your particular Fios interface box also have an 802.11 function? In other words, do you have wireless 2 gigahertz communication between that box and your computer? In other words, your computer doesn't have to be hardwired to the system. Is that the service you possibly have, Alan? KC2RFN, K2RIW?
Yeah, I don't have Fios. I have Cablevision. But it's the Netgear router, which does have wireless on it, and as soon as I hit the power button, it instantly shut it off.
Interesting. Okay. So what is that signal, in your case, really doing is not quite clear. Dave, AK1NS, give us your information, Dave, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Same thing, Fios disconnected, issue went away, it was 600 cycles, particularly at 28320, and at 20 meters it comes up again. And then we ran a quick test with an 857 and a 10 meter antenna in a vehicle, and went to 2 known addresses with Fios, and picked up both signals in front of the houses, pulled 50 feet away, and it completely went away.
I want to add that Dave and I have not been talking, and my receiver is set to 28320, dead on the nose. That was the highest sounding pitch.
How about that? I guess one of the interesting questions now is that is this unintended emission, that's what it sounds like, an unintended emission, does it violate the current rules for extraneous interference, microvolts per meter or whatever? The quickest way we can find that out is what range at which can you guys hear it? Let's see now. Both John, Alan, and Dave have all made range measurements, and I think when we finally get to Howardy's, we'll find out from him, too. And I know that Joe, I think, has made some range measurements. What do you believe is the greatest range, first with you, Alan? What's the greatest range between the source? In your case, it was right in the house. And do you believe you're the only person that's hearing it? In other words, when you turn off yours, you don't hear anyone else in the neighborhood. This is what I think you're saying. John first. Here we go. Alan. KC2RFN. Go ahead, Alan. K2RAW.
KC2RFN. My router's only 3 feet above my receiver, so you're not going to get much close. It's not going to be easy for me to test the range on this, but I have not... Since I shut it off, I have not picked up any more of those tones. So if my neighbor, I'm sure all my neighbors have routers, my nearest neighbor is 100 feet away, and it's not making it into my receiver.
Now, probably you're listening to this by way of a coax cable going up to an antenna that's on the roof in the backyard or whatever. So that allows us to make a guess as to how far away between the source of the signal and your receiving point, that antenna. Roughly, what was the S-meter deflection, the strongest component? Was it S9? Over to you, Alan.
Between S5 and S7.
Okay, that's not a super strong signal. And that might be within the rules, if you know what I mean. John, what was the S-meter reading when you made a measurement? Make a guess as to how many feet between the antenna that was doing the receiving and the source, and what S-meter reading did you get, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
My antenna is roughly 30 feet from the box, and I was at an S7, but when I went to the driveway, which is about 80 feet away, it was way down. I could hear it, but it was not making the S-meter move. But when I went to the rear of the house and went about 200 feet, which is a lower level of about maybe 40 foot that road, I could pick it up there at an S1. So the pattern is a little strange, but those are my readings.
Okay, that gives us a little bit of a ballpark figure of signal strength. We're now going to go over to Dave, Howard, and the new person who just signed in that order. Dave, how far was there between what you believe is the source and your antenna, and what S-meter reading did you get, Dave? AK1MS, K2RIW.
AK1NS, S-meter I'm reading right now is S9 plus 30, distance is straight line, 15 feet, and here is the tone. Sorry, go ahead.
I think you said you were going to give us the tone, Dave, and I didn't hear the tone yet. Go ahead. Plus 30. The noise that I'm hearing in the background with that tone, do you believe that noise is on the signal itself? It's not because it's a weak signal and the noise is coming from your receiver. Now give us a guess on that one, Dave. AK1NS, K2RIW.
I'm not sure, Dick. I couldn't tell you exactly. I just know that if I disconnect that Fios, it'll stop, and if I go no more than 50 feet away, it disappears completely.
be interesting to note that noise changes at all when he turns the box off, Dick.
Yeah. Well, if he was S9 plus 30 and he turns the box off and his receiver goes down to S3, let's say, that's a huge difference. So that would strongly suggest that the noise itself is built into the signal, like there's a digital modulation along with that tone. Howard, how far was the distance between your source of that 28 megacycle signal? How many feet between it and what you were using as a receiving antenna? And what was your S-meter reading? WB2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I can't give you an S-meter reading, but I can give you some information here. First, I was going to tell you that I'm in the FM portion of the band, and we've been getting some 50-cycle, or actually 100-cycle, noise when the band opens up coming from thermal, you know, those heat shrink machines that warm up, that wrap, and we're getting that out of South America, and people know about that. It's an intruder on the 29 meg. Also, Dick, I am using a half-wave vertical up at about 400 feet above sea level at the repeater site, and we get all kinds of noises. We can sit up there with a spectrum analyzer and see a signal as strong as negative 80 or 70 dBm, and it varies throughout the day from fluorescent lighting, from computers. But I will tell you that what I have noticed is that a lot of the digital electronics, we have internet up at the site that's wirelessly done over the 5.6 gig band, and everything from digital routers to other equipment does prevent the problem. You just have to shield everything, do a lot of good grounding to try to eliminate it. Some of it comes through the power line, some of it comes from your own equipment in your cabinet that has computers. So I will say that 6 and 10 meters, when you start to try to do low band work, you know, low band FM, it is a challenge, Dick. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
WJ2B with a comment. WJZMB with a comment.
Okay, lots of people with a comment. Thank you for that one, Howie. WJ2B, start off with your comment, sir.
I've experienced the same problem with home Ethernet wiring, and it's not only emissions, it's also susceptibility, because I had a 100-foot run of Ethernet cable from my router down to my shack, and it was actually being interfered with. If I would transmit on 80 meters, I would lose my Ethernet link, and then when I stopped transmitting, it would come back on again. So not only is wired Ethernet causing emissions, it's also susceptible to interference from high-powered RF fields. So wired Ethernet is not very nice when you're in an RF environment, like similar to being near a ham radio. So your best bet is to either get away from the wired Ethernet, which has to do with the quality of the cable. If your cable is low quality, you're going to get more interference. And also, if you shield it, it will improve it. But your best bet is to go all wireless. 802.11 with the 2.4 gig, it will give you the most quietness and the best performance as far as low emissions and low susceptibility. So wireless is the way to go if you're dealing with ham radio environments at WJ2B.
A quick comment, Dick, please.
Okay, good. Yeah, Cat5 cable, if it's used correctly, which is four twisted pairs within that cable, if the sending unit really is operating properly in the pure differential mode, and the receiver also in the pure differential mode, even though it looks like it's not shielded, I can give you a lot of shielding capability, 30, 40 dB worth. So when you're talking about high-quality cable, Joe, when you're talking about the better brands of Cat5 or Cat6, is that what you mean? Or, without a doubt, if you're not using wired system, if you're using 802.11, at least at 28 megs, you're not going to get much of a problem. A guy on 2 gigs might. But when you talk about higher quality cable as a way of solving it, are you talking about a shielded version of Cat5 or Cat6, or are you talking about the higher quality Cat5 or Cat6? That'd be J2B, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Dick, I really can't answer that 100%, but my solution was to go to wireless. As soon as I got rid of the FNET, like you said, if the receivers or transmitters are not of the best quality and the cable is not of the best quality, you're definitely going to have problems with the high RF fields, you know, both emissions and susceptibility. But that tone that he just played sounded very similar to BPL. So it's basically high bit rate digital data over unshielded, you know, even if they are twisted pair, if the system's not perfectly balanced, you're still going to have emissions, WJ2.
Dick, I can tell you what cable I use to get rid of most of the problem.
Yeah, we're going to go over to Eric first and then Howard in that order. And there's a comment I was going to make, and it went out of my head. Go ahead, Eric. KE2EJ. I know that in the broadcast industry, you guys use all kinds of high-frequency interwiring, and my guess is properly shielding that to make sure you're not getting electromagnet interference must be a bit of a task, or you guys got it down to a science. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Major ZMB comment.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, let me say this much. I've run into lots of problems with Ethernet using TAC5E and TAC6 cable. And 100% of the time, the noise problems that I run into is people don't wire the damn connectors properly. So they don't get a differential pair. They get a cross pairs. You know, they use these little testers to make sure that they're wired right. But doesn't tell them that they hook the right wires to the right pins, so that the transmit side and the receive side are appropriate for balance. So, cut the connectors off, you know, put them on right, and the problem goes away. And I just have a lot of stuff that's sensitive on the receive side, and I transmit with a heck of a lot of power. And do it right, it works well. K2RWK, do that.
That's a good point, Eric. Even though the system could be miswired on both ends as far as how you're using those four twisted pairs, and you may make the system work, but if you're not using it in the intended manner, an awful lot of that beautiful shielding characteristic. As inexpensive as it looks, Cat5 cable, if you study it, it really is a beautiful piece of engineering. You've got a total of 8 wires in there, 4 twisted pairs, and if you study it carefully, you'll realize that each individual twisted pair has its individual twist rate. There are 4 individual twist rates. So even though those leads lie alongside of each other, after 500 feet of being parallel, because the twist rates are the same, the signals tend to cancel. It's a beautiful piece of engineering. So which cable did you use, Howie, to make the problem go away? WB2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Acute situation up at the site. Kayvon and I, we have antennas on the site that take in the digital signal, take in the RF signal, go to digital. So we have about a 100-foot run, and we went to weatherproof shielded commercial cable. I don't remember the name, but it was around $60-$70. It's completely shielded, has a tin foil, and yes, they have to be wired correctly. If you don't wire them correctly, you have all kinds of issues. That's one thing. Also, you want to use power supplies to go to the equipment that all have these chokes on it. All of that stuff is very important to make sure you got good grounding on your outlets. So that's really what's happening. So for our digital motor turbo and everything else, and whatever else is going on that we're doing with, we found out that good practices are important so that the high-powered UHF stuff and whatever else we're doing does not interfere with the stuff. We have no interference. You've got to make sure, Eric is 100% right, you've got to make sure those pins are connected correctly. Because if not, you don't get the good shielding. And the only other thing I can say, Dick, there's a lot of noise coming out of South America, and there's a lot of other stuff. But I will say that I found out everything from the controllers, like the 850, to all the new digital electronics, they do generate noise. Even some of the power supplies, some of the switching supplies give you headaches. So
So, you know, you live in a tough environment these days. You know, you got square waves, and all of these square waves generate harmonics all the way up the RF spectrum. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Another update, Dick.
Okay. Thank you, Howie. We're going to pick up K2ZMB, but let me pick up ZMB, and then we'll go back to Alan, the guy who asked the original question. K2ZMB, it sounded like. Zebra Mike Bravo, please correct me. Tell me your name and then your comment, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
You got it right there, Dick. It's Kilo 2 Zulu Mike Bravo in the mobile here. The name is Justin. A lot of the stuff's been already said, but I'll reiterate, being a networking guy, connect the right pin to the right wires. The wiring diagrams are online. Look them up. If you're going to go with shielded twisted pair, make sure you get the appropriate shielded connectors to take advantage of your shielded twisted pair. And check out the a lot of these cheap routers, cheap switches, cheap wireless extenders, etc. have cheap power supplies, which are noisy beyond noisy beyond noisy all over creation. Usually you can get lucky, fix it with some chokes, you know, a couple turns through a ferrite, stuff like that. I've seen plenty of people have taken the ferrites off because they were in the way and put it back on, problem solved. So hopefully that little bit of knowledge helps somebody, and that's about all I got. Kilo 2, Zulu Mike Bravo.
Thanks a lot, Justin. Good stuff. Alan, with your update, KC2RFN, look what you started, K2RIW. You got it, Alan.
KC2RFN, yeah, Dick, I figured if it's affecting me, it's probably affecting others. But after listening to what Eric had said, I decided to start individually pulling some of the Ethernet wires out of the back of the router. And, of course, the one I had made, I thought, would eliminate the signal, but it didn't. So I kept going down, and then when I got down to the fourth one down, I unplugged it. It disappeared, even though I still have the power on the router on. And I realized that this was a line that was recently put in by my alarm company to hook up to my DVR so I can watch my security cameras on the Internet. And I suspect what Eric said is exactly what happened, because the color code inside of this does not match the color code of my other cables. So I think he's right. There's probably transmit-receive that aren't on the proper twisted pair. Once I unplugged it, problem went away instantly.
AC2GY with a quick comment, Dick. Sorry for the late check-in.
AC2ZMB with another comment, too.
Okay. Let me ask a quick one to Eric first. Eric, I vaguely remember that when it comes to 802.11, here we go, when it comes to Cat5 cabling, and the proper color code going to each of the connectors, I vaguely remember there's more than one standard, and that creates a little bit of confusion. Or am I mixing that up with a USB cable? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, actually there's two different standards. I don't remember the EIA numbers. I think it's like 492A and B. And there's also two versions of the reversing cable. But the twisted pairs, I think the outer twisted pairs, I'm not sure whether it's the orange or the brown to get reversed. But if you follow either one of them, it works correctly.
As long as you do it correctly on both ends. Okay, the next person, AC2GY, Russ. Go right ahead, Russ, with your comment.
What might help, and what I've typically seen people screw up, is when they crimp the cable, they don't realize that for 100 meg, so 100 base T, pin 1, 1 and 2, and 3 and 6, are the pins that need to be paired. Gets a little bit more complicated when you go into gigabit, because gigabit's actually using all of the pairs, but it's 1 and 2 is basically pair A, and 3 and 6 is pair B for 100 meg. The other pairs aren't actually doing anything for 100 meg connection. They come in when you're doing gigabit, but if they have like yellow and blue and then they crimp them the same but wrong, you don't get the twisted pairs eliminating the RF. And it sounds like that's what the other gentleman has. Back to you, Dick, AC2GY.
N2MB, comment.
Hi, thank you, Russ. And Barry, N2MB, I bet you you've done quite a few of these installations, or you've been called in as a consultant to solve some of these problems. I bet you've seen some pretty hairy wiring. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RAW. Go ahead, Barry.
ABTV.
Okay, yeah. Now, when you're doing the 1, 2, 3, and 6, and I forget the other numbers, but you have to respect all the colors properly and don't reverse the colors. Off the top of my head, I can't remember, but you look it up on the internet, you can find it. Just put, just type in Cat 5 pin out or something on Google, and you'll immediately come up with that information. But you've got to respect the polarity. You know, if it's blue, it's got to be blue and then white blue. I think it starts white blue and then blue, you know, like that. You've got to respect the colors and the polarity of those colors all the way down the line at all 8 pins. You've got to do all 8 pins. Believe me, I run into this a million times. And also, you should realize that these digital power supplies that everybody is using now, these switching power supplies, some of them can be really bad, and they'll spread RF noise all up and down the band. Back to you, Dick.
I have the answer, ABTV.
Thank you, Barry. Good stuff. AB2Z. Alpha Bravo 2 Zulu is what it sounds like. Start off your name, sir, and your comment. KQRAW in the TechNet.
To United Victor, name is Rob. Do a lot of cabling work. I can tell you, it's the codes that you're referring to is 568A, 568B. You're right, it's 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1 and 2 is the blue pair. Depending if you're going A or B, 3-6 would be orange or 3-6 could be green, depending whether you're going A or B. The most common would be 568B. That's the most common coloring that's out there. The other two pairs, like you said, are not being used. The brown pair hardly gets used except like 6 gigabit. And like Barry said, you gotta follow the color code of 1 being white with the blue tracer, 2 being blue. And then what's interesting is 4 and 5 are opposite. That's the center pins. And if you look at a telephone connector, that was always the first pair of telephone being 4 and 5. Those are opposite, the red and green. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah, thanks an awful lot for that, Rob. It sounds to me like a person can choose the standard 568 Alpha or 568 Bravo. By what process do you decide which one of those you should use? AB2UV, K2RAW, go ahead, Rob.
It doesn't really matter as long as you follow the same code at both ends. If you're wiring one end Alpha, you wire the other end Alpha. That way, pins 1 through 8 or pins 1 through 8 at the other end. Your pairs will stay the same. You're right about the engineering of the twist. Each pair has a slightly tighter twist if you look at it. I think brown being the tightest. So it doesn't really matter if you go the A or the B route. Like I said, most common is B. I've wired pretty much everything B. Whenever I do the data jacks in the wall or the crimp on the connectors, always go with the B.
Good thing, B.
Okay, thank you, Rob. Who is the person who just signed in? I started with the full set of call letters and names, sir.
Kilo 2, Zulu, Mike Bravo. Just one other quick piece. It was mentioned that the alarm company did a little wiring. Sometimes they go cheap and they use like Cat 3 wiring. You know, oh look, we've got enough conductors. And they don't realize the implications of that. So make sure you're using Cat 5, Cat 5E, Cat 6 as appropriate, and not some lower categories of wiring, as that can result in problems as well.
Thank you, Justin.
Comment.
Don, good information. Wes, go ahead.
Actually, a statement about alarm companies using Cat 3 is for what? For the zones, they use four conductor telephone wire, gauge 22. So the only way that they could use a cut 5 or cut 3 is if they have a telephone connection or the telephone network connection from the Verizon high-speed internet or from the modem of Time Warner. And to XGN.
Yeah, I think there's a difference in the wiring to the sensors for an alarm system versus the wiring that communicates the information over something like an internet. Tom, good question. Thank you, Alan. Howard, you had a question. WB2HWW, K2RIW. Okay, maybe Howard got called away. Rich, N2EO, I believe you signed in with a question. Go right ahead, N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO, good evening. Dick, it's a computer question. Maybe it belongs on the computer net if you can't answer it, but it's kind of quick. I just bought a netbook, which for those who don't know, a netbook is a small computer without a... It's got a hard drive, no DVD, CD drive. Haven't picked it up yet. I bought it on Thursday. I got to pick it up at PC Richard on tomorrow. And I'm wondering, it's a small little computer. I want it from the ham shack because I don't have a lot of extra room down there. It comes with something called Windows 7 Starter. I'm wondering what Windows 7 Starter is. It's some kind of a bridge version of Windows 7. I'm not sure how much memory is in it. I think I can add memory. It's got a 250 gig hard drive. I'm wondering if I can put a regular copy of Windows 7 on there. And what won't Windows 7 Starter do that the full version will? Want to use it for right now just for spotting DX stations on 6 meters, but eventually I want to use it for rig control on an LEcraft K2. Back to that, N2EO.
Dick, it's AC2GY. I can answer his question if you'd like.
I sure would, Russ. Wait for the beep and give us your answer, Russ.
All right, sorry, I missed your call sign because the phone rang when you were speaking, but Windows 7 Starter is basically a light version of Windows. With Windows Anytime Upgrade, you can upgrade Windows Starter. Of course, Microsoft's going to charge you for it because it's a feature license. But depending upon the speed and CPU of the netbook, provided that it supports it, you can do an online upgrade to any version of Windows, provided that Microsoft certified it on the hardware. Would probably be a better question to go in depth during the computer net, but Dick, I guess it's up to you if you want to take it further. AC2GY, back to net.
Don, good answer, Russ. And I think that's 50% of what he wants to know. I'm very light on computers, but my son, KB2IQN, is slowly establishing himself in Upper New York State where he'll be able to check in, and he's a computer person from way back. I hope that gives you most of the beginning of your answer, which sounds like it's going to cost you some money, but it sounds like you've got the ability to upgrade. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. N2EchoWatch. Well, I want to thank the gentleman very much. No, I don't know what processor is in there. I bought it basically on price. It was $269, and I bought a USB DVD drive for $99. Boy, the stuff has really come down. I needed something inexpensive for the ham shack, because I have an Apple iMac that I have up here in the bedroom. So I needed something really inexpensive in the ham shack. I don't know... What I really wanted to know is if the processor, I got to find out what kind of processor, but if the processors in general in these netbooks are abridged, or will they support Windows 7? I have a legitimate copy of Windows 7 in the house that I would like to install. So that's all I want to know, Dick, and then go on to the next customer. K2RIW, TechNet Weimark, M2EM.
Can you pick me up for my question? Somehow I stopped transmitting.
Russ, you want to give him AC2GY, you want to give him a brief answer to that last question, Russ? Go ahead.
If you have a license of Windows and you want to lay it down on another machine, and it is not, I'm stressing this, Windows 7 has not been installed anywhere because Microsoft does online certification of their licenses. You have to call their license group, and provided that the machine will support it, for that you're going to need the minimum memory and processor requirements. Microsoft can do an immediate online transfer of the license to another machine, so you don't need to worry about USB keys or CD-ROMs or DVD-ROMs. And then with Windows Anytime Upgrade, you could then upgrade the machine using the license. But best thing to do is when you get the hardware, see what's in it, make sure that you meet the minimum requirements, and then there would be nothing to stop you license-wise from upgrading, provided that you haven't used that Windows 7 on another machine already, because Microsoft has really cracked down on their new licensing methodology, and you would need to have a free license. I hope that answered your question, AC2GY. Back to you, Dick, in the TechNet.
Yeah, very fine, Russ. Lots of good information there. Thanks an awful lot. Howard, I know you had a question. You said you had some trouble transmitting. You're transmitting beautifully now. Go right ahead with your question. HWW, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Kayvon actually came into my house. Two things. Number one, I want to say hello to Rob, and to say we had... Yeah, the wiring is correct, and Robert's been a help. He knows all about that stuff. Okay, Dick, here's my question. K4NBC was up to town. I don't think he saw you because he got an emergency. He had to go back home. But he dropped off a pair of antennas to me, Dick. I got two inverted Vs made up. Okay, here's the question. He just reset. Question is this. I can co-phase. The antennas have a good SWR. I can co-phase these antennas. I am going to go right from the inverted Vs, right into a balance, and then I can go into two quarter wave, 75 ohm phasing cables to get, you know, my phasing and to get an impedance of 50 ohms. Okay. Or I can take two feed lines of the exact length, run them like 80, 90 feet or whatever the distance is into where the equipment is, go into a T connector, and then go into a Pi network or into a matchbox, a simple, you know, two-capacitor coil, and adjust that with best SWR for my best match. Because if I take 250-ohm feed lines, I'll have 25 ohms. Which is the best way for me to go? One way, if I use the phasing, well, I got a weatherproof orbit connection. It could be a little bit more complicated. Or I could take two exact feed lines, come all the way down, and go into my T connector and then into our network to bring me from 25 back to 50 ohms. Trying to decide which is the best way, and I am going to use balance for the simple reason is I don't want the coax to pick up noise. These are going to be for receiving, so because of all the electronics that's out there, I don't want the coax to pick up, you know, to pick up. I'm going to balance the line by going through a you know, a one-to-one balance. Back to you, Dick.
In a certain respect, I've been there and done that one, Howie. I once won an antenna gain contest by combining either two or four Yagis on 432 megacycles. I was doing the combining of pairs of Yagis, 50-ohm antennas, by simply plugging them into a T-connector, a Type N T-connector, which, yes, does give you a pair of 50 ohms in parallel, 25 ohms, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in the worst case, gives you a half a dB of insertion loss, and so therefore the measured gain of the pair of antennas was half a dB lower than it could have been, but the antennas were high enough and performance worked. As you can tell, people lose an awful lot of sleep worrying about exact impedance match. Yes, if this is a Cadillac system and you want everything to be perfect, you use a perfectly constructed Wilkinson hybrid with the 100-ohm balancing resistor inside of the assembly and whatever. you and I know that a receiver is extremely forgiving. A receiver can look into a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio and still give you extremely high performance. I think you're wearing very unnecessarily. I'm assuming your two inverted Vs are going to be set up either as vertical stacking or one north-south and one east-west. I mean, there's a zillion different ways you could use it. But as long as if you want to combine them in a known way to have equal length of cable going to the shack, so you can do all kinds of switching in the shack. Let me drop.
Right, but here's the question, Dick. If I go into a matchbox, I still get the phasing, so I don't have to use 75-ohm transmission line. I can do it that way. Which way do you think I'll get better performance? If I use an LC network, it's basically the same thing. I'll probably only have a tenth of a dB of loss.
If you want the most amount of adaptability, as I see it, Howie, individual, reasonable, high-quality cables, yes, with balance, on each individual antenna. You bring the two feed lines into the shack, and now you can combine them in a zillion different ways. Put them together with a T-connector. Put them together with impedance matching. Put them together with another set of quarter-wave impedance matchers. What are they called now? Ballon-like structure, you know what I mean. And switching them in combinations where you plug in a 90 degree or 180 degrees of extra length of on antenna number one versus antenna number two before combining them and vice versa. In other words, electronic steering. My recommendation is you bring in individual cables, and now you can try a zillion different combinations in the shack. When it comes to are you going to use an antenna tuner of brand A or brand B, if it's a receiving function, the exact number of ohms the receiver sees almost doesn't matter. If there's such a strong impedance mismatch, like a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, where the receiver is going to see 3 dB less signal on HF frequencies, it sees 3 dB less signal, it sees 3 dB less noise, the signal-to-noise ratio is the same. So if you're not going to be transmitting through it, exact impedance match doesn't matter anywhere near as much of making them co-phase for the particular signal on the assumption that both antennas are going to be picking up the same signal. Maybe one's horizontal, one's vertical, maybe one's north-south and one's east-west, and so on. So you've got a lot of experiments you can do in the shack and have a grand old time doing electronic steering, if you know what I mean. But don't lose a whole lot of sleep about exact impedance match to a receiver antenna on an HF frequency. I wonder if you see what the point I'm making on that one, Howie. WB2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely see that. Yeah, it's going to be for a repeater system. It's going to be for 10-meter FM. Okay, Dick, I thank you very much. I already have an antenna, a little LC network. But I want to get the maximum amount of signal to noise. It won't make much of a difference going into a commercial receiver. I appreciate what you said. Everybody have a great day. I just want to say, Dick, play around with HF 10-meter FM. It's been a challenge with all the noise. The noise floor is constantly, you're constantly fighting, and you can ask Barry N2NB. On 6 meters, all the hazing and everything is a real pain. WD2HWW. So, Dick, thank you so much.
Yeah, very fine, Howie. As you assemble that antenna and start doing these experiments, let us know how that works. The next person on the list was Les, K2TGW. Les is the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club official parliamentarian. We shouldn't be keeping him waiting this long. Sorry about that, Les. K2TGW, K2RIW. Go ahead with your question.
Dick, thank you. Well, part of it's a follow-up, part of it is a question. Let's start with the follow-up. I asked, I don't know, 6-8 weeks ago in reference to some small PA or brick for a D-Star 440 with a straight FM small brick work. The answer is yes. You understand that, Dick?
I think I do, but go right ahead with your question, Les.
Question is, getting a little older, I set up a small station on the first floor. The objection for the tall, blonde, blue-eyed lady that I live with has not been terrible, so I got away with it. Now, outside, I have a 40-10 meter dipole, standard 40 meter, and I put an extra 10 meter sides on it. If I wanted to put 20 meters on that, must these lines be separate, or can they actually be curled, or just somewhere as laying next to each other as they, in this case, they would become an inverted V? Dick, back to you. This is K2TGW.